The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, Lucy Kennedy, Ireland's favourite nosy house guest and recently turned author, joined me live in studio to chat about her second children's book, The Friendship Fairies Go to School, which she completed during lockdown. Wendy Moxley shares her story about growing up in a violent home with an alcoholic father and how she used this experience to do something very positive with her life. Writer, political strategist and mental health advocate Alistair Campbell joined me to talk about his new book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression. And our very own Sinead O'Connor joined me to chat about how she's studying to join the health service, her upcoming single in aid of Black Lives Matter, and how much she's loving life as a grandmother. And last but certainly not least, Kelly Stewart Harcourt, daughter of the great James Stewart, discusses how she felt after hearing of her father's character George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life being compared to Donald Trump, and why she felt compelled to write a very important letter. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. Lucy Kennedy, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing? Please excuse my appearance. I have hay fever and I was filming yesterday and I've forgotten my hair straightener.
And, okay, well, that's a lot to take on in one breath.
How is my friend?
Are you sure it's hay fever and that's nothing more serious?
No, it's definitely nothing more serious.
Do you have a persistent cough?
No, I don't.
Oh, that's okay.
No, I don't, doctor.
Just have to double check, but we are beautifully social distance.
I know, we
can't
sweet embrace for the first time in 15 years. How long are we friends?
Thereabouts. But that's the nature of it. It actually saves me then.
I think you're relieved.
I am, actually.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
I find the avoidance of a lot of embracing quite useful.
I know. Well, you are an embracer.
It can be.
You like a good hug.
Except that the handshake, I was kind of ahead of my time with the hand sanitizer, I must say.
But you know what? I can't get used to the whole elbow thing. It doesn't feel right.
Not really working, is it?
No, it's not. And especially if you're trying to relax someone in your company, it's just a bit, I feel really cold. I don't feel like I'm being me, but it's got to be done.
Isn't that the line, is stop trying to make elbows shaking a thing? You know, it's to paraphrase that line. It just doesn't feel...
It doesn't feel right. And when people keep on saying the new normal, this is not normal. I can't say the new normal.
Somebody said last week here that it's not the new normal, it's a new abnormal.
Yeah.
That's better, isn't it?
It is better, because it's not normal.
You're kind of meant to be at the school gate this morning.
Yes. Oh, some friend.
So let me guilt you into the first ruminations as your...
So Holly, number two, my mini-me, as Mum said, I gave birth to myself. So you can imagine the devilment there without completely letting her down. But so she's 8 and she is going into third class today. Hello, everybody. Look, she's fine. You know, I trust the school. I trust her. I trust her teachers. I trust the new system in place. So Richie, my husband, was going to drop her in and I came to talk to you.
How old
are you? Bye, mummy loves you. Gone.
Gone.
Yeah.
Got to put some clothes in the back here. How old are the other children at this point?
The other children, Jack is 10.
Yeah.
So he's in fifth class.
Yes.
Can you believe, A, that I'm a mother, and B, anyway.
No, so social services are making their way over as we speak. They hadn't heard. Go on. So A,
so,
right, 10,
so, Jack is 10, Holly is 8, and little Jess, whose hairstyle is like Boris Johnson at the moment because I cut it, is 3.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're all brilliant. They are mini-me's and they are just such good crack. I've inherited my devilment.
I'm kind of concerned because as the late late comes back on Friday, do I have to ask every single person who sits in front of me, how was your COVID experience? And I am aware that it can be a bit trying, but I'm going to ask you this on the basis that you've got 3 kids under 10, 11.
Yeah.
You're pretty much the kind of demographic for us in terms of listeners that you'd have 3 kids that you homeschooled, that you're now getting ready to go back to school. How are you? I mean, how have you been since March, and how have your children's mental health been? How have your nerves been? How's it been?
It's been kind of up and down. To be honest, I think that the bit I hated the most was homeschooling. I truly think that childbirth was easier. Like, you know me in real life. Mm-hmm. My maths, everything is pretty basic. My skill is talking, full stop.
Yeah.
So I had a 10-year-old. So basically Nova moved to my dining room the following day, March 13th.
That's your radio station and show. Yeah.
So I was broadcasting live every morning, doing Jack's homework. He was 10 on Zoom calls with his school. Holly is in a different school, so she has other needs. She wanted me to do her homework. Potty training Jess. So literally doing the weather, and I hear, I've done a poo.
Yeah.
You know that feeling of, oh God, sweat. Yeah, trickling down my back. Trying to kind of act casual and be professional, but it was hard. Like, it was really hard.
Was it the running around or was it?
It was the running around. It was trying to kind of do my job to the best of my ability. You know, trying to have meetings, trying to be a mum. Like, dividing myself into five. It was exhausting. And I'm not going to lie, there were a couple of days where I just lay down on the ground and cried and thought, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And when is this going to end?
Yeah.
Slightly easier when school was finished because they were with me and I was more chilled out. You know, they can watch telly, play in the garden. I wasn't worried about homework and stuff and Zoom calls with teachers. Mm. But it's kind of been up and down, you know, I think that's everybody.
That is a great way of describing it, because you'd some days be going, look, the weather's great and I'm getting all this time with my children and
yes,
it feels good. And then you think, as you just said a minute ago, wait a second, a pandemic?
I know.
Here?
Yeah.
In my lifetime?
Yes.
For how long? There is no answer. When's the vaccine coming? We don't know.
I know.
When are those horrible figures on the news every night going to stop freaking me out?
Yeah.
I don't know. And it was the uncertainty.
Whole thing.
And yet, do you feel with the school gates opening comes a sense of renewal or a reboot of dealing with this thing? Or are you still feeling a little anxious? Or how are you?
The truth is, half of me is elated and on the verge of having a party.
Yeah.
And the other half of me is scared.
Okay, well, deal with the second bit first. What are you scared of?
I'm scared that they're going to get sick, or I'm scared that the schools are going to close again, or I'm scared that this is all going to go wrong. I don't really know what I'm scared. I suppose when they've been with me since March, so I've been washing their hands and kind of looking after them. But there is that sense that they're gone now, and I just have to trust the system. Mm.
And that's what you know. The acting chief medical officer was saying that we do have to trust the schools. They've been working on it.
Yeah.
And that there will be the occasional flare-up of COVID here, COVID there, but hopefully not the full lockdown.
Hopefully not.
No, we're just rolling with it. It's like living with somebody deeply unpleasant. Happens to be a virus in this case. Hmm.
Lived with a few of them.
I can only imagine. Let's go back to the first bit about the part of you would love to party. What does that mean?
Well, I'm just excited that there is that sense of normality again. While it's not normal, you know, seeing Holly's uniform outside her door and her bag packed for her, I think it's nice. She's going to see her little pals. I think that small people need small people. So I feel happy for her because she's going to think that life is normal again. I don't think children are that aware of that age of masks and visors. And I think they just want to see their friends.
Yes.
You know, we have the fear, they don't.
What do you miss most about pre-COVID? Like last February?
I miss hugging. I miss physical contact. I don't miss going out. You know me, I'm actually a bit of a nerd in real life. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather have a bottle of wine, watch telly in my pyjamas. Mm. I miss physical contact. I miss being able to interact with people properly without having to step back on the pavement, or I miss just being able to be me, you know?
Were you struck by how amazing the over 70s were, without being patronising, and I really mean that,
yes,
because there's nothing worse. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And how they really had a tough go of it, right? They were told, get in. And you're going, what? Like, how dare you? You know?
I know.
It's kind of undignified in some ways. And they really railed against that word cocoon. They hated it for the most part. Did you get the sense that for them to stay in and do all these things that were, I think, pretty challenging and unpleasant, they kind of deserve a bit more of a bit more love than they got, I think.
I think so. Very much so, actually.
From society.
Yeah, it was that kind of like, you know, just lock them up, they'll be fine. You know, drop groceries on their doorstep.
Yeah,
it felt a little bit weird. It was like, you know, yes, I do. I do think that. I agree with you. And my own dad is 84, so he's...
Is he really?
Yeah. Can you believe
it? Has he still got the twinkle in the eye?
Oh, bitter.
No,
he says the mad Kennedy laugh.
Yeah.
But, like, I felt with dad, we were kind of looking after him, but it was just... It was like, bye, Dad. You know, can't come close to you anymore. Just at the window. He was like someone who was caged. He was just locked up and put away. And then any time he tried to sneak out, he'd get into trouble. I don't know. It was just weird, wasn't it? Like, older people are like us. They need to interact. They need to feel they have a purpose in life. They need to be able to go and get their own milk. I know they're at a higher risk than us. But I did. I felt very sorry for the cocooners. I did.
There is, you know, even in the text messages and you talking to friends or whatever, that the finger wagging to people is getting a little tiresome. You know, and people are just a bit fed up with the, you can't do that. You can't do that.
Yes.
You can't do that. And a lot of it's coming from a good place and just saying, just for the sake of us all.
Yes.
But I'm sensing that there's probably a need for a little more tolerance and a bit more peace and love.
Yes, it's getting a little, there's a couple of spats going on at the moment. I think I don't get involved in that. I never do. I'm just minding my business, looking after the people who I love and wearing a mask.
Well, you see, I think you're probably in a part of that majority that we don't hear an awful lot from because they're too busy getting on with their lives rather than making
exactly
a lot of noise.
Yes. Well, look, I like to be in the papers for the right reason, to be honest. And but I'm just listening to what we've been told to do, which is just wash your hands, you know, keep your distance and wear a mask. And that's what I'm doing.
Did you watch any particular series or program or thing that got you through this whole thing?
Normal People.
Was that really? Was that your thing?
Yeah.
Oh, so you fell in. You fell into the Normal People.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
you got on the train.
Did
yes,
you?
I mean, obviously, it was an unavoidable.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Something to look forward to, wasn't it, every week? Because, like, there wasn't much on the telly, and I've kind of been through Netflix 56 times. I'm now on Disney Plus. I'm at that stage.
Actually, we watched Ratatouille on Saturday night.
Oh, I love Ratatouille.
Haven't seen it for ages. And it's a great PR for rodents, broadly speaking.
Yeah.
And also for the world of cooking in Paris or whatever.
Yes.
It was quite a cute movie.
I have one for you. Write this down. The one and only Ivan.
I haven't heard of this.
Oh, Ryan, you're going to cry. I cried.
I don't want to cry at movies now. I'm not in the mood for crying.
No, everyone needs a good cry. Wait till you need a cry, then watch it. The one and only Ivan. And it's about this big gorilla. It's a true story.
Oh.
He was basically raised in a supermarket in the States. Like in a, yeah. Okay, you're not taking
no,
me seriously.
I'm taking it down.
Okay, just watch it. Just watch it. And then text me as you cry.
I think I'd rather go and see Tenet again than seeing some monkey in a supermarket working in Spar.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And
is
you
he wearing
will
a
cry.
Mask?
And then I'm not gonna spoil it, but the NT is free. I've just bought it.
Okay. Well, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
It's kind of Free Willy, but with a gorilla.
Exactly. Free Willy with a gorilla. In a supermarket.
The world needs new more fairies, and this is where you come in. I'm impressed that you here you come with another edition. The Friendship Fairies Go to School.
Yes.
Here we are on the very day you're abandoning your own children to let Richie take them into school. Have to come in to talk to us to talk about your book.
Yeah. Well, it's tradition now for you to launch my book.
Well, I appreciate that, and it's my honour to. The Friendship Fairies Go to School. Which includes my favourite thing in it, of course, being the fairy cross code. This idea of the green cross code meets the fairies. Remember one, look for a safe place type thing.
Yes.
So when you're writing these books, in between crying on the floor, watching Paul Mescal in his chain and shorts.
In the shower.
In his shower. And
drinking wine.
Potty training one child.
Yeah.
Homeschooling another. Not helping one in maths and being worse with the other with Irish.
Yes.
And then trying to make sure your husband's, all right with each other. You know. And my question is, where do you? When does the book come in? Where's the timing? And a radio show. Sorry.
And a radio show.
I'm wrecked just talking about you.
And preparing. Yeah. Yeah, I am. Look at my face. I have no blood in my body. So Gill Books have been brilliant.
Yeah.
And in fairness, they have held my hand. And there was always going to be a couple of these books, not just one. So they said, look, you know, it'd be great to have the book kind of ready and turned around by May. So after Christmas then, I kind of started making a plan with them what we're going to do. Lockdown happened and I pretty much wrote the book in 3 weeks.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did. And, you know, I'm wearing false nails today for your butt.
Yeah.
I'm not a typer. I do it all on my phone. So I could be in the bath.
You write
sitting
it on
the
your
loo.
Phone?
Yeah.
No.
Yes, I do.
That would drive me around the twist.
Would it?
Oh, I can't. I hate my phone
but
anyway.
Are you a slow typer?
Yeah.
Ah,
I type like a dad.
Yeah, okay. Well, I type like a mum. Mm, but
I basically
did it all on my phone and then I'd copy and paste it because I could be anywhere. I could be in the park, you know, pretending to watch them on the swings. Look at me. Look at me.
Your illustrator, Philip Cullen, by the way, obviously.
He's Irish.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
And he obviously works fast.
Oh, yeah. He's a speedy boy. He was living in Japan. and he's home in Ireland now. And it's brilliant. It's a really nice feeling because obviously I have all these fairies in my head. We all know I'm away with the fairies anyway, and I'm still in that zone. I have two little girls like you.
Yeah.
Mine are obviously smaller, but you know the way little girls think.
They're always your little girls. Yeah, yeah.
Very, and I love it. And it was an easy enough book to write because I'm in that zone. But I think now more than ever, and going back to school, we had to kind of rush the process to get it in time because it is a little bit tricky for everybody going back to school. And in this book, the eldest fairy starts a new school. So she's trying to make friends and that can be hard. And so it's touching on, I suppose it's touching on serious subjects in a very light way.
Do you know what's quite difficult, which are one of the reasons I quite like that strand in your book, is that imagine starting a new school today. And let's say you're the new kid in the school that they've all been there before.
Yeah.
And then you're now in a pod. So you can't just mix it up. Then and then you've got a mask on.
Yeah.
Depending on what age you are. They're perilous waters to navigate for a lot of kids at the moment in the school. And that's not to try and hype up the anxiety. It's just simply saying...
No, that we're acknowledging that they must be nervous.
Exactly, that they must be a little bit nervous. Nothing wrong with saying that either. But
no, definitely not. It's good to talk anyway, isn't it?
Precisely. But for the younger ones going to school for the first time or hanging out in this kind of strangeness, to come home to your friendship fairies, I think it was a real bam for kids, for mums and dads to read this story and go, all right, they're managing, they're pulling through, you know, they're getting there together. So that's why this is the timeliness of your book and the kindness with which you write, because you're a kind person, just oozes out of the book. So congratulations on it.
No,
it's a real beautiful
Ryan.
Thing.
Thank you.
Brenda was on today. I just love Lucy. She's a breath of fresh air.
Brenda.
She's so genuine and a beautiful soul.
Oh,
no, she doesn't know you. She doesn't know you. Let's take that apart a bit. Genuine.
Look, are you getting all philosophical on a Monday?
No. Genuine.
I am genuine.
Beautiful soul.
I do have a beautiful soul.
You sold that 10 years ago to get living with Lucy. Breath of fresh air.
Yes, I am. Well, not today.
Well, it was about 15 minutes ago. I was getting stale now. How's living with Lucy going? Can you record it?
God, with friends like you, eh? Yes. So it's lodging with Lucy. It's not living with Lucy.
Oh, go on. What?
You're such a...
No, I'm not. I'm just curious to know what it is.
It's called Lodging with Lucy. So basically, I'm not telling you the guests.
You're in one yurt and they're in another. You're looking at each other.
Oh, no. So this is the truth. Obviously, in Living with Lucy, thank God people watch Tipwood. Bless yourself. You will do it one day. Even if I've got to come to your house and drag you, you will. You will do it.
I'm not giving you an address.
I'll get your address.
Go on.
But so we were thinking, okay, I have to do Living with Lucy, but how do we do it? So I... thinking, oh my God, you know, because I can't fly, obviously. Yeah. I don't want to, and we have to keep it Irish, which is not a bad thing now more than ever in hindsight.
Yeah.
And so I actually said to Rich one evening after a good bottle of Malbec, I went, right, people are coming here.
Yes.
And Rich said, Luce, go to bed. And that was it. Because I thought, well, what if people come to our house? Not that it would be vaguely exciting, but it would just kind of change things up a bit. And that lasted 2 seconds. I let that one go.
Yeah.
And then we thought, okay, why don't we go to like a neutral location? So now I have this beautiful country B&B / mansion / Georgian house with a chef. I'm not telling you where.
Come on, no, but what part of the country is it? Just a county?
In Ireland.
Yeah, that's the island.
No, I'm not telling you, because then you go and have a look.
I won't.
I see you a little peering through the bush.
What county is it?
Spying on my guests.
What county is it?
Meathish.
That's all I need to know.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
So basically then what happens is the guest is... He's typing it, he's Googling.
Go on. Go on.
So the guest... So I stay there overnight, obviously, because I'm like the lady of the manor.
Yeah.
And then they come to me and then they can stay for the whole day. They can stay for lunch, have dinner, or they can stay the night. So we've had both. People have come for just the day. It's like a long day.
So who did you spend this weekend with?
I can't tell you.
I thought I might catch you on the hoof there.
No, I can't tell you. Even. But I have spent time with Paul McGrath.
Yeah, I saw a clip of that. Yeah, he's a beautiful human being, isn't he?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Like, I admired him before, but now I'm a full-blown fan. And would you believe, throughout my Podge and Rog days and everything I've ever done, I've never asked anybody for an autograph. Mostly because I've forgotten, but also because I'm not that kind of person. Well, within seconds of Paul McGrath arriving, I had my son's Ducky United shirt and signed it for Jack, which Jack will never wear again. And it's now hanging in
on
his room.
On eBay for what?
No, it's not on eBay.
It's hanging in his room. Sorry, that's great.
Well, I've never asked anybody for their autograph, not even yours.
Someday. The two people I love, says a text, and are on my bucket list to meet are you and Lucy Kennedy. I just love her. She is so funny. I'm glued to the radio here and can't wait to read her book.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
They must have the wrong name.
Mum.
There must probably what do you call that when you put the words in and
I'm
it gets the wrong name?
I'm leaving you
Was feeling very down this morning, Ryan, but not anymore. Lucy Kennedy is a breath of fresh air. Loving the chat between you two. I'm laughing now and I'm cheered up and I wish her family well.
Oh, thanks so much.
Good point at which to end our interview.
I have to go now, do I?
Yeah, I've got some more to do.
Well, what do you have to do?
I've about 6 or 7 minutes of
yeah,
kind of...
Chat. Let's chat about
no,
you.
No, because
how
I've got ads and I've got music and I've got more text to read and I've got to... You know, it's all going on.
I've got way more things to discuss.
I will come back and talk to us again. Hey, listen, thanks for coming in to see us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm fine in answer to your question. I'm fine.
Good.
A little nervous with the late light coming back on Friday. Get a little antsy this time of year.
Oh, yeah, of course. I know exactly how you feel.
But I'm excited too. Back to school.
No audience?
No audience. No.
Okay, that'll be tricky.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's. But like I was saying
the other day, it's a different vibe.
It's like. It took me a couple of shows, but then it's like. It's like doing a radio show.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
once you get into that, it's fine. Anyway, that's.
Wait, can I ask you?
Guest.
Sorry, I know you're trying to get rid of me, but
I'm not going to get lodging with Lucy in my own studio. How did this happen?
Exactly. Good luck trying to get rid of me.
Yeah.
Who's on Friday night?
Do you hear that, Sam? That's security coming downstairs.
Just tell me, who's on Friday night?
I'll tell you tomorrow, the day after that.
No, because I will be in your audience, if they're good.
At home, with a bottle of Malbec.
Oh. Okay.
The Friendship Fairies, Go to School by Lucy Kennedy. It's a beautiful addition to your kids' bookshelves. Be sure to get it today. And actually, it's a gorgeous looking book as well as a beautifully written book
Thank
by somebody
you,
who cares. And it's really good to see you, Lucy. As always, you're
and
just
you.
A wonderful human being. See you soon.
Thank you, pal.
No hugs, though.
Oh.
Mm-mm.
Not gonna happen. Little kiss.
Not even. But I want to say good morning to Wendy Moxley. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
It's very, very nice to talk to you. How are you keeping?
I'm doing. Thank you. Yeah, good. Very good. Thank you.
You did something rather altruistic and very generous during lockdown.
I did a bit of a mad thing.
You sure did. I liked the name of it, Head to Head.
Yeah, deliberately chosen.
Tell me about it.
Well, I was due to go back to work, but things transpired that I couldn't.
Sure.
They couldn't take us back on, so... I decided I needed to do something that was worth doing. We had heard the statistics coming out on the radio about women in relationships that were less than perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Just going off the rails completely during lockdown.
Yeah.
And I thought, I have to do something. I knew what that was like. Well, I knew what it was like to live in that.
Yeah.
I wasn't a victim myself, but... I knew what it was like to live in that terror, so I decided to take up. You know, everybody else was walking during lockdown, so I just took it a step further and walked the length of the country.
How many miles did you cover in the end, Wendy?
Miles, I don't know. About 610 kilometres.
Or kilometres, I should have said. Yeah, that's amazing.
We've gone mad.
So head to head, Millen to Mizzen.
Millen to Mizzen.
And it took you how long?
18 days. And 18 Ordnance Survey maps.
Congratulations. And how much did you raise for Women's Aid?
So far, about 7,600.
Wow. And what was your hope?
3,000.
Wow, that's tremendous. Congratulations.
That
yeah, that's just, I just love
fabulous.
Hearing that because people have their own things going on and, you know, financial concerns. And yeah. You just mentioned Women's Aid and during the COVID particularly, and just, it's worth the statistic that the free phone line has had about a 40% increase.
That's right, yeah.
And the website has had a nearly 75% increase.
Yeah.
That tells its own story, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? And about 25% increase to Gardaí. So
yeah.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying.
I want you to bring us back to the pub in Cork that you grew up above.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I want you to tell me, if you wouldn't mind... at what age you were when you realised your parents' relationship was far from ideal?
I couldn't actually tell you what age I was. It was always there. Mm-hmm. It was always chaotic. You know, when my father walked into the house, you're walking on eggshells. You know, it was terrifying. You never knew. He was an alcoholic and a violent one. And so you never knew what was coming through the door. I mean, he could be great crack. but he could be vicious. He was kind of like a street angel, house devil, and you didn't know which one of those was going to come through the door. So I don't know what age I was when I realised he was dead when I was going on for 10. Mm. He died very young. So that threat was always in the house. You know, he could kick off at any stage and you could hear the screams, the roaring, the beating at any time. I just remember one incident where he was locked out. It was small hours of the morning, I presume, we were all in bed asleep. And as I said, we lived above the pub, so he got a ladder up to the window of the room that I was sleeping in, and I was sleeping beside the window. And I heard knocking on the window, and I didn't know what it was. You know, at first I thought it was a bird, like a big crow or something. And I opened the curtain, and he was there, sort of saying, "Let me in, Rent, let me in, go on, go on. Just open the window, there's a good car." And initially I kind of was terrified, said no, no, no. And eventually, of course, he got around me and I opened the window and let him in. And then followed by screaming, crying, beating, it was terrifying. And then the guilt for doing that. And it still haunts me.
When you're that young and you hear those sounds, and I'm conscious that people will be who went through that same situation as you did will be remembering this morning. So I hope they're okay.
Sure.
Could you try to put me in the mind of the youngster that you were then, listening to that through the walls? What do you hear and how do you feel?
I was about 7 or 8, I'd say, about that stage. But it was always going on. But at that particular incident, you know, I kind of pat you on the head when you came through the window, and then that is then immediately followed by the sounds of my mother screaming and the sounds of thuds, you know, of her being beaten. So, and that guilt, that never leaves you.
Can you explain the guilt to me, please? What were you feeling guilty of or for?
And allowing him in, and allowing that to happen. And I know it's not. I know intelligently it's not my fault.
Mm-hmm.
But inside you just feel as though if I hadn't let him in, that wouldn't have happened.
Can I ask you what state was your mother in the next day, physically and emotionally?
She'd hit it. She always hit it. She would wear, you know, even in the height of summer, she would wear long sleeves or something, or she would hide it. And she wouldn't say anything. There was never any discussions. She got up and she, you know, as you said, we had a pub, so she ran the business as best she could and carried on. Nothing was ever said.
Was he careful about where he inflicted the thumping?
Nah.
Really?
No, no. She wore a lot of makeup, and I think it was just it was blind temper. I think that I don't think he was careful about where. He just he would kick a chair from under, and she landed on the Aga spike one time and made a big hole in her back. But I don't think it was premeditated. It was just vicious.
Kicking a chair from under somebody. As a husband to a wife in front of mm-hmm. the kids, is I don't know why it turns my stomach so much. I think it's the humiliation of it as an image, as well as the practical physical cruelty of it. That's something that you remember clearly.
Yeah. Just there was always the shout, and his mother lived with us as well, and I remember. Her and my mother both kind of trying to calm him. You know, they'd be arguing out on the landing when we were supposedly in bed asleep, trying to calm him down and trying to coax him, but that didn't always work.
Tell me a little... go ahead.
He'd go off for days, you know, I mean, you wouldn't see him for days, and then he'd come back and the car would be crashed, or, you know... He would often not be there, so that was fine. But when he came back is when it just all went weird.
And it was this constant emotional lottery as to which numbers you'd pick when he came through the door. Did you get the win or the lose? Was it mostly a lose?
He could be good fun. He could easily have had kind of an underlying psychiatric problem, for all we know, which is masked by alcohol or caused by, who knows, chicken and egg. But you never knew. You never knew which one came in. Was it the street angel or the house devil that came in that door?
Did you love him or hate him?
I think I loved him. When he died, I remember I wasn't at home. I was brought to school and told by a nun at school. I wonder why he didn't like, actually. But anyway. Mm. And I remember I was thinking, I'm supposed to cry now. My father's dead, I'm supposed to cry. But I didn't feel like crying. Which was kind of odd.
Have you cried since about him?
I'm not sure if you could say I cried. I've certainly cried, but I'm not sure if it was because I missed him or because of what he had done, or I suppose I have, yeah.
And as an adult now, how do you assess your father as a person?
Oh, cruel, nasty. Yeah, he needed help. And I suppose my mother certainly needed help. You know, she was battered. She was running a business. She had four kids. You know, it was hard going.
Can I ask you about conspiracy? And by conspiracy, I mean conspiracy of silence. Whether that's neighbours, community. I don't know whether your grandmother as well. I'm not sure. And this isn't about blame, as we started our show talking about, really. It could be about societal conspiracy. Mm-hmm. How does a man, and this happens all the time, and I know it happens, violence
happens
against men too. No, I do. I appreciate that. That's why it's so important to be talking about it. How is it that it, no matter how often we say, well, this was the 70s, it was different then. It's 2020, and as we're speaking, somebody could be getting the living daylights kicked out of them in their kitchen because the egg wasn't boiled properly.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk to me about conspiracy. Talk to me about silence.
It's shame. There's an awful lot of shame attached to it, I think. Mm-hmm. I think as a victim, I haven't been, but I think as a victim, you just feel like, how could I have let myself in to do this? And then you're trapped.
Yeah.
And then society, as you say, kind of not so much conspire, but don't know how to deal with it. Because if they approach it, it could make things 100 times worse for the victim. And the victim is afraid to do anything about it because it could make things 100 times worse. And often there isn't an outlet. You know, there isn't a way out. In my mother's case, I suppose, it was because he owned everything. And church and society were just against breakups in any case. No matter what, for what reason.
He had control, didn't he? He controlled...
Complete control.
The household.
Complete control.
Yeah.
And she had four kids. Where do you go?
Do you have any... Do you have any warm memories of your dad?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah. I mean, sometimes he'd come in and just play with you. Or, you know, I don't know if you know, where you catch a child's two hands and kind of swing them between your legs and those kind of things. Just playful like that. Shortly before he died, he took me for a spin on my own. This had never happened. He brought me out for the day and he died close to Christmas, so the Christmas annuals were out. So he bought me a Beano annual or something like that, and we went out for the day, which was very strange.
But you were happy.
Didn't feel normal.
You were happy in that moment, by the sounds of it.
It was nice to have been kind of brought out on my own with him, kind of having that time, but it just felt very strange. I felt uncomfortable.
Because kindness was alien to you from your father?
Yeah, and being with him on my own was completely alien.
There were four of you, you say, four siblings. Was it discussed or was it the great unmentioned?
Oh, it was very much the great unmentioned.
Really? So even with the thuds and the bangs
even
and the screaming.
Even among us. Yeah, no, never talked about it. And I even didn't know the detail of it till I was an adult.
And is it the subject of discussion over coffee, not now necessarily, but as an older person, as you got older, did you sit down together and say, Jesus, lads, that was not good?
No.
No,
probably
really?
We would have kind of said, not so much sat down over coffee and had a discussion about it at all, but you'd say, oh, remember this. Oh, Christ, I was mad, but, you know, do something daft and or crazy, or that an incident might be mentioned, but not a whole conversation about.
How old was your dad when he died?
41.
And how did he die?
Massive heart attack. That was alcohol related, I imagine.
Okay, and you said you didn't go to the funeral. You weren't brought to your funeral. You were told.
No,
you were told by a nun. You said that
school, yeah.
You mentioned, and I slightly misheard you. Did you say a nun he didn't like or you didn't like?
No, I didn't like.
You didn't like the nun in question. Okay, well that's all right. That's between you and the nun, in some regards. But Wendy, tell me then at the age of 9, do you still feel? Because I think at kind of 7, 8, 9, kids are much more cognizant of what's happening around them than they get credit for. So let me ask you, would you have preferred to have gone to that funeral?
Absolutely.
Really? All these years later?
Absolutely.
Why?
I felt very left out. I didn't have any family member around me for a week, maybe two. I was at my godparents' house, so I just felt very alone. And not knowing, you know, my father had died. Okay, he was a so-and-so, but he was still my father. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to have been there. I'd like to have been with my family, my siblings, my mother. But they were... And I think it's very important to include a child in their parents' death.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of salutary lesson for a lot of people to hear that this morning. Let me ask you more about more recent times in terms... Well, no, actually, Jim, before I do that, I got the sense there's a happy news story in the sense that when your father died, that ended a very, very dark chapter in your family's life.
Mm-hmm.
Did your mother find happiness ultimately?
She did. She married, less than 2 years later.
Great.
To a man that was a dote, an
Lovely.
Absolute dote.
Lovely.
He adored her.
Great.
So she did. Did find happiness, which was great. And Brian, my stepfather's son, is just a gem as well. He's one of our brothers. We all found happiness. I mean, we were all a bit feral, I suppose, when my father died.
Yeah, okay.
And Ray came into our lives and kind of... He was so good. He was such a good man.
I'm just very happy to hear that your mother found happiness ultimately, and that there was a sort of, I hope you don't mind me saying so, but there's kind of a sense in that, you know, that that your father dying so young allowed your mum to have that chance.
Yes, I don't know if I should say it, but I mean, she's, you know, because she had no way out of the situation.
Yes.
She used to say, like, he had the good grace to die young.
Okay. She's entitled to that, I think. After all,
yeah.
When you were in lockdown, I don't know if you have a family of your own now or what's your situation.
Yeah, I have three kids of my own, but they're all grown up now.
Okay. Did you find yourself thinking about the claustrophobic nature of a house?
Absolutely.
Really? Tell me about that.
I'm in a very happy position of having a gorgeous partner and my son living with me, and I was just acutely aware of the fact that we were in lockdown and we were stuck. And I'm really lucky that I was in a loving position, you know, a loving atmosphere. We all like each other, but that's not the case in every home. And I was so aware of it that's what really spurred me on to take off across the country.
Head to head. I mean, it's a carefully chosen name.
It was carefully chosen, yeah.
Because it sums it all up, I'd say.
There often is a head-to-head.
That's it, exactly. Whenever we talk about this, we talk about Safe Ireland, and I was involved in a campaign some years ago. I always like to mention it because it's so important, which is the Man Up campaign, which is to get men to get it stuck into this.
I think that's so important, and it's so brilliant, because we kind of forget to take the focus on the subject of all of this, which is the men. Mm-hmm. You know, and by their exclusion, they're kind of erased from the conversation or from the issue. You know, that really no man should treat a woman or child like that, and we need to say it. And men need to, like you said, man up with each other and sort of not accept, you know, degrading comments or harassing women. It's not okay in any shape or form.
Let me get some texts that I'd like to read to you, if you don't mind, because there's a lot of response. 51551, and if you want to donate to womensaid.ie, head there and /donate and make a contribution, because this will help. They do need it at the moment. There's a massive increase in calls, a massive increase in visits to the website, and that can only mean a massive increase in...
And the refugees are
out the door.
Bulging. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is because there are men and some women who are beating the living daylights out of their partners first thing in the morning, at lunchtime, and then late into the night. And it is a sickness and a cancer in this country that will only be allowed to thrive by silence.
Absolutely,
This woman, says the text, is right. Shame is a huge part of this. I lived with an abusive husband for 15 years. I left 5 years ago, and I still feel shame at times, even though my head knows it's his shame and not mine, which is so true. Another says, this story takes me back. Brave woman telling my story, but children are beaten as well in your case and walked on eggshells. That makes my stomach, it puts me on edge, that eggshell thing about, you know what I'm talking about. The chaos, says another, and the shame. But as a child, you don't understand those emotions. It takes a lifetime to work out the damage caused by the demon that is, in this case, alcoholism. Liz says, Ryan, you carry that sadness and fear with you in adult life. I know. Listening to that lady, that is Wendy Moxley, who's our guest this morning on your show, it's bringing back very painful memories of living with an alcoholic father who was a nasty man. I still remember the fear every night going to bed, not knowing what would happen when he came home from the pub drunk and beating my poor mother up. I'm 53 now, and it still affects me. Children are affected for life by living with domestic violence. Emotional, and I'm upset in Galway at the moment. And of course you are. That's why we do need to talk about this, because we need to either, one, tell people who are being domestically abused that the shame does not belong to them. It belongs to the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. Two, if you hear or see any of this, you need to make your presence felt with the relevant authorities. That's critical. And three, if you're in a position to, donate to the likes of womensaid.ie, and that'll help make a difference. We had the same feeling when our mother came home from work, as another. She was just awful, a nasty woman, violent to us, her children, very controlling. Another, what I remember is the total weakness that came over my mother, total powerlessness. And that is intriguing. These women who are beautiful mothers, gorgeous sisters, and who are strong human beings, but in the face of these monsters, they crumble because of the control these people have over them. That seems to be the case, Wendy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's control.
Yeah.
Total control.
You raised €7,000. Let's try and raise a bit more if we can for Women's Aid today. It would be a nice thing to do. And we can only have done that by talking to you. So thank you, Wendy, to you, but also to your family for allowing you to talk to us. I know it's a big thing, but I think it's a desperately important thing. So thank you for making that change, for people this morning. Last word from you, Wendy, to people who are sitting at their kitchen table terrified and mortified and ashamed. What would you say to them?
Reach out, contact Women's Aid. They listen and they believe you, which is a huge thing.
That'll do nicely. Wendy, you mind yourself, and thank you kindly for your time today.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
Pleasure to talk to you. Wendy Moxley joining us on the phone this morning. That helpline is 1800 341 900. That's 1800 341 900. But of course, probably is easy just to go straight to their website, womensaid.ie, and you can as I say, make contact, make a difference, change your life. Or if you want to donate, obviously that's something that will be very, very happily accepted and appreciated. And thanks for those comments today. Not easy for a lot of you to write a lot of the things you did, but hopefully Wendy's interview this morning was of some assistance to you. Most of you listening this morning will know Alistair Campbell, a British writer, communicator, political strategist, mental health advocate whose career has taken in journalism, politics and everything else in between. His new book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, is a deeply personal account of how his depression has affected his life, but also how he's learned to live better despite it. And he joins us this morning. Alistair, you're very welcome to the programme. And the first thing I'll say to begin with is how I was struck by the tone of the book. Made me feel like I was eavesdropping on a session between you and your psychiatrist.
Well, that's very, very good that you say that, because I actually took a copy. The first person I took a copy of the book to was my psychiatrist. It's the guy called David Sturgeon, as you know, and I do feel he was a very, very important part of me getting to a much better place with my depression. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is I'm now 63. I think it's taken me a long time to get to a place where I have learned to live with it, even though I still get it, and even though it can still be very, very crippling and brutal. And I hope that if people are out there who are struggling, that they don't take as long as I did to face up to some of the things that you need to do. And, you know, I've included in the book some of the, literally, you're eavesdropping some of the stuff that we talk about, because I've included a lot of the things I've done with him to get me to a better place.
Just dwelling on the psychiatrist piece for a moment, you speak in the book about the importance of getting the chemistry and trust right between psychiatrist and patient, because I suspect a lot of people have went to a psychiatrist, they like a bad date, it didn't work out, and then they went off and didn't ultimately address the problem.
Well, one of the things I really like about David is that even when he's putting me on this medication or that medication, he never ever says, this will do the trick. He says, look, this is always trial and error. I don't know if this is going to work, but let's give it a go. And the other thing, it is about chemistry. And I think people should, you know, keep going. It's inevitable in life. You know, you'll have guests on your program, and some of them you like more than others. Teachers, you know, whether they like to admit it or not, they have some kids that they like more than others. And it took me a while to find somebody that I really, really trusted. And I really do trust David, and he's become a very important kind of guide in my life. And I don't name some of the others, but the one that, for example, when I went to see him and he said he was worried that maybe, you know, the press would be sort of hacking emails and eavesdropping, and therefore he should give me a code name. And he called me Abraham Lincoln, which I don't think was very good for my I'm not sure. Given that one of my constant refrains is that I've never fully achieved my potential, I'm not sure that was a good thing to do.
You know, you mentioned medication there, and you talk about your psychiatrist or whichever one it might be, and the frankness of your story separates you from the, I suppose, the tone in which mental illness is dealt with, and mental health, I should say, is dealt with, and particularly depression. It's still, is it not, and you'll tell me because you know, is it still a sense of taboo, a sense of stigma, a sense of, I better not say it because I'll be reduced in other people's eyes?
I think there is, and I think that's one of the reasons why I've talked about this for a long time, as you know, but I think doing it in this way and being, as you say, completely frank about it and about what it's meant for me and for my family and for my partner and my kids and my parents and everything else is just to say that there shouldn't be that taboo. And, you know, I make the point in the end of the book that cancer used to be a taboo. We used to call it the big C because we didn't want to talk about cancer. The fact that we now talk about cancer, people don't feel ashamed, they don't feel they have to hide it, that has helped people who get cancer. And likewise, I want to try to do the same with mental health, that nobody should feel any more strange about going to see a GP because they feel they've got depression, or they feel they've been hearing voices, or they've got OCD, or whatever it might be. The first step is to admit you have the problem. That is the first step to trying to deal with it. And I took years of decades trying to pretend that I didn't have a problem. And it was only when I really started to admit I had a problem that I could begin to deal with it.
Did denial feed it?
Definitely, definitely. Because what denial does is it makes you feel worse about it, because you absorb the feeling that this is not just not right. You know it's not right because you're not feeling right, but it also adds that almost that moral dimension that this isn't right. It's not right that you feel like this is the wrong way to feel. There is something wrong with you, and that feeling is then what inhibits you from saying to somebody else, "Do you know what? I'm not right. I don't feel right. I need help." And I think that what's been interesting is like, for example, Fiona, my partner, we went for years where I would just say, "No, I'm fine. Leave me alone. Stop nagging me. Why are you asking me if I'm okay? I'm absolutely fine." And now that I'm very, very open with her, she's got better at dealing with it from her perspective as well. And likewise, I mean, I think a lot of our children's friends, you know, they sometimes sit around when we're talking about stuff and they say, "God, you know, it's amazing the way you guys just talk about how you're feeling all the time." But it's helped all of us, I think.
There's often a sense of like a spectrum when it comes to depression, and because it became, when mental health became much more talked about, you felt some people might have been possibly, this might be very cynical, jumping on the bus in a way. Mm. And if you're in the spectrum, so you go to work on a Monday, you've got what I call the blues. And then, you know, some days you might have something horrible happen in your life and you become very down, if you like. In Ireland, we have the expression, she took to the bed or whatever. Now, at the other end of that spectrum is a person who feels like they have a foot on their head and they're being pushed into water, and or a foot on their throat. Proper, to me, depression. Do you believe in that spectrum, Alistair? And because I know you have your 1 to 10, and maybe talk us through both.
I do believe that because, you know, if you just... One of the things I want to campaign for is for people to feel they can talk about their mental health the same as we do our physical health. Now, if you stop somebody, you bump into somebody in the street and say, "Hello, mate, how you doing? How you been?" Now, that is sort of a question about your life, but it's also a question about your health. And you might say, "Oh, well, I've got a bit of a cold." Right. "You got a bit of a cold," or, you know, "Oh, I've been having a terrible problem with my back." Now, we don't think there's anything odd about saying that. But actually, it's just the same for our mental health, that we don't feel the same every day, and we don't feel the same every part of every day. So I have this thing where when I wake up in the morning, a lot of my depression is dictated by how I feel when I wake up. And if I wake up, if I feel, I give myself a number for that feeling, and if I, one is kind of deliriously happy, 10 is actively suicidal, and if I'm straying beyond 5 into the 6, 7, 8 territory, I start to worry, and then I start to do some of the things that I've learned to do to try to get my health, my mental health, in a better place. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should all go around every sort of small talk becomes about our mental health and well-being, but actually, I think in the workplace, for example, particularly now with the strangeness of COVID and all the sort of weirdness that we've all had to live through, I think actually starting that question with not just how you're doing, but how you're feeling is actually not a bad place to start a conversation these days. And I think if we can feel that we can be open about it, I think that first step to talking is a really, really important step.
Now, I wouldn't have had you out as one for the gratitude list.
Why not, Ryan?
I think I get the impression you're a rather testosterone-fueled chap who wouldn't be into that sort of thing that belongs to other people.
Well, may I say, despite having met you many, many times, I think that is very dangerous stereotyping. No, I think I am put it this way. I think it's important that we all try to be grateful and try to express gratitude for the things that really matter. And I think that it's only when you do that kind of thing, and that is one of the exercises that I did regularly with my psychiatrist. When I was feeling bad, he would say, "Okay, you're feeling bad. Let's push that to one side for a minute. Tell me the things you feel grateful for." And once you start to list them, you actually, it can help to lift your mood. You know, I mean, if I think about during the COVID thing, and, you know, it was weird for everybody, as I say, but actually I did start to go out, you know, going out for a walk with the dog became like a, "God, this is nice. Listening to the bird song, seeing the trees and all that sort of stuff." So once you actually start to say, "I can be grateful for that." And then when you get into your relationships and, you know, the fact that the kids give you so much joy and your partner is so supportive and all this sort of thing. And then once you've kind of established that and you start to say, oh, God, you know, I'm really grateful for the fact I can play the bagpipes. I'm really grateful for the fact I love listening to Motown. I'm really grateful for the fact they've got a good bike. And it can actually, that can trigger a shift back up, if you like, back up the right end of the scale.
Yeah, it's funny, as one gets older, the sheer joy in what a younger me would have thought was mundane and taken for granted. You're in the same zone there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's like, you know, that now look, listen, don't get me wrong, there was a period of lockdown towards the end of it when I had a really bad depression, mm-hmm. and there was nothing you couldn't get me to go for a walk, you couldn't get me to go and, you know, take those simple pleasures. But when I am in the mood to do that, then, you know, there's frankly nothing better.
When you see it coming, is it like looking at a horrible bus coming to take you away? Is it that obviously on the way, a slide?
It is that obvious, but it's not like a bus. It's more like a very slow and very kind of I've called it sometimes. It's like a. It's got a smile, it's got a look on its face, and it's got a bit of a feel of jelly. And it's not taking me away, it's coming to take me over. So it sort of comes in, it then just pours into my veins and takes me over.
Like a lascivious baddie in an old film.
It's not even like that, because it's not like, it doesn't, I don't give it a kind of human embodiment. It's I can't even, and the other thing to say is it's not always the same, but the most common feeling is it's like this oval shape. It's about five times the size of a rugby ball. It's above my head, and it slowly comes down and it enters my head, and then it goes right through my veins. And before I know it, I can't get out of bed.
It sounds terrifying, but that's the whole point of your book, I suppose. And it brings you just on the gratitude list. And of course, I was joking with you about you not being that sort of person, obviously. The resentment list. Which do you I'm not enjoy writing most, but is the resentment list helpful to get stuff off your chest?
Yeah, it is. And also, I think what I found helpful about that was the fact that after a while, some of the things that were on it, you thought, I mean, you don't really resent that. Therefore, the gratitude list was so much longer. And I think that I hope that for most people, they've got enough in their life that can be the case.
Yeah, so you know, sometimes when you're trying to do a crossword and you can't get anything and you go away and you come back and you finish it off in a jiffy. And I wonder sometimes if you write a resentment list when you're not feeling great, can you go back to it when you're feeling better and say, God, what was I worried about? Look at all that resentment. I don't really feel that.
Exactly. And actually, when I was writing the book, I really, really, really forced myself to do more, to make it longer. But in the end, I couldn't. It was just things that I said, no, I don't really resent that at all. I don't care about it.
Can we isolate an incident in your story, Alistair, which found yourself, you know, punching yourself in front of Fiona? And explain to us, how did that come about and the impact of that?
The impact of it, thankfully, was that was the point at which I realised that I couldn't do this on my own. I had to get help. But what had happened was it was after I'd left number 10, so it was 2 years afterwards, I was still being pressured by both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown to go back, and I was getting gradually drawn in. Fiona and I weren't getting on terribly well, went out for a walk, and I just felt this kind of rage inside me, and I started beating myself up. I mean, you know, quite badly. I mean, like, you know, bruised eyes and throwing myself about, and you know, Fiona was just standing there looking terrified, and that was the moment when I realised that, you know, you've tried your best, you really tried to work this through on your own, you can't do it, and that was what led me to go and seek out David Sturgeon.
And you're back in the psychiatrist's chair then, and it was clearly a critical thing to do for you to stay on the straight and narrow.
I think so, and I think, as I say, I think it was really lucky. I actually was, again, he was personally recommended by a friend of mine who was already seeing him, and that, I guess, made me feel more trusting towards him. And it's back to the thing about relationships, is the minute I met him, I thought, this guy's okay. He's not saying crazy stuff. He's really listening, and I felt, you know, and your dad was a psychiatrist, and I'm sure he will have had lots of patients who just, they stuck with him because they felt something very, very personal. It is it's an incredibly personal relationship because, you know, you literally, as I say in the book, you know, at one point he was asking me to record my dreams as I was having them or as I was waking up and writing them down and emailing him so as he could think about it for the next session. You go from not knowing somebody to talking about the innermost secrets of your life and your heart and your mind and everything. It's an incredibly personal relationship.
I still get letters, Alistair, from former patients of his to the show to say how important he was to them on the other side of the counter and at the desk, as it were, and how they wouldn't probably be alive or around without his, which is very gratifying as a son.
I'm sure it is, and I'm sure that... and I always think the reason I have so much respect for good psychiatrists is that, you know, the physical doctor who's got, you know, they can do blood tests, they can do x-rays, they can fix things, whereas all the psychiatrist has to go on is what they're seeing and what they're hearing. There's no... they can't sort of do an x-ray of the heart to say why you're feeling sad. They've got to probe away, they've got to try to spot patterns. And, you know, I say there's at the time that we were doing all the dream analysis stuff, I mean, I've got to be honest that most of the time I thought this is just complete nonsense, it's a total waste of my time. But actually I started to see patterns and he started to see patterns and that's when we sort of started to make progress.
Is it the case that both your brothers died at the age of 62?
It is the case, and I just beat them because I turned 63. The book was meant to be published in May when I was still 62, and it became a bit of a family joke that, you know, would I be the first to get past it? But yeah, both my brothers died young, but my older brother Donald had schizophrenia.
Yes.
And, you know, the combination of the very, very heavy antipsychotic drugs, it does take about 20 years off a lot of people's lives. And my second brother Graham, he was a very heavy smoker a lot of his life, very heavy drinker, and he lost both his legs in we all ended up leading pretty different lives, but I think we had a lot of similar issues.
Was it peculiar to celebrate your 63rd birthday knowing the importance of the age of 62 and your brothers?
It was, in a way, but I mean, partly because it had become a bit of a thing within the family about, you know, oh my God, he's got 5 days to go, will he survive, and all this sort of stuff. But yeah, it's sad when you know when somebody loses their life young, and you know, and I still feel, even though I'm 63 now, I still feel very, very young. I feel young at heart, really, you know, to think that both my brothers have gone is not just sad, but I also think that, funny enough, particularly with my second brother, I feel that there was a lot of waste there. I feel he had an awful lot of talent and he just never made much of it.
Returning to your book, because when people go to the shop to buy your new book, Living Better, they'll see Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, Alistair Campbell, but they might be struck by the colour scheme, and because it's blue and white and red, and one might think, oh, he's obviously a patriot, loves his country, loves his flag. Could you explain the importance of the colour coding of your book cover, please?
Do you know what? I hadn't even thought of that. The design, I love the cover.
Yeah.
And I think the design's brilliant. But I'm going to ask you now whether that is what it was about, because you're obviously referring to the fact that when I had my breakdown,
yes,
I became obsessed about the colours red and blue.
Yeah.
And the politics in my life. And no word of a lie, that had not crossed my mind until you said that just now. So to tell your listeners what that was about was that when I had my breakdown and I was arrested and hospitalised, I became convinced that I was part of some sort of, I'd been kidnapped for some sort of weird Thatcherite re-education programme, and I had to go from being red to blue, and I had to go from being left to right, and I was refusing to do it. So, for example, if the doctor said to me, are you all right? I would say no, and I'm not going to be, on the basis that I thought he was asking me to become right wing. And likewise, if I saw red or blue, they just kind of completely freaked me out. And it's interesting, when I've mentioned this to other people, this appears to be quite a common thing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure your dad met plenty of people like me. Or maybe it's green. Maybe it's green and green. Yellow in there.
Maybe that'll be the cover for somebody else's book when it comes out here. Okay, before I let you go, because you like love talking about politics as well. Just a few observations, if I'm. Were you over the Phil Hogan resignation story last week, or were you too busy doing something else?
No, I was, and actually, I actually tweeted. A clip, the clip he did on RTE of announcing it, saying, you know, how refreshing it was to see somebody accepting responsibility, given that we on our side of in the UK have seen a succession of ministers and senior ministerial advisors like Dominic Cummings blatantly refusing to accept responsibility. So I thought it was sad in a way, because I think, as Ursula von der Leyen said, he's been an extraordinarily good commissioner. But I do think, you know, people have to take responsibility for their own actions.
Secondly, the new leader of the Labour Party, is he the sort of guy you want there? And would he kind of coax you back into the mainframe then?
Well, he's certainly better than the last guy. And I think he's done, I thought he was excellent in Parliament in his first few outings. I think he's done the right thing in terms of, you know, trying to sort out, particularly deal with the anti-Semitism problem that arose under Jeremy Corbyn. And now it's about the policy agenda going forward. So he's definitely made a very, very good start.
And finally, Alistair Campbell, I'm completely wasting my time asking you what you think of Boris Johnson's handling of the COVID crisis. Probably am.
Well, you're going to be really surprised to hear this, but I think he's been an absolute disaster. No. And I think the reason for that is, I think both in terms of his character and his competence, he's not up to the job.
Thought you might say something like that. Alistair, it's always good to talk to you, I must say. Mind yourself, and thanks for your time. Congratulations on the book. It's wonderful.
Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Nice to talk to you. All the best. Alistair Campbell.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Joining us this morning. Bye for now. His book is called Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression. Like I say, it was like eavesdropping a session with a psychiatrist and an extremely articulate and insightful patient. And that's available in bookshops as and from tomorrow. The text number is always 51551. Good morning, Sinead.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
Oh, it's great to talk to you.
You too, man.
Can you remember how like exciting it was that that Friday just this time last year with all the services?
It was very moving indeed. It was. I remember being almost crying. That it was very moving when they were all coming on. It was incredible.
Because you said that you wanted to meet them, that you I just think you seem to have great respect for these people and what they do.
Yeah, in particular, I find cops terribly attractive, and I have a huge affinity with soldiers. I really love army people, soldiers.
Okay, yeah, because of their the line of duty or anything else in particular?
Because of the line of duty and because of the voluntary program I told you I did before a couple of years ago, just for a very brief period. I was on this program working with veterans in America.
Yeah.
So I grew to have a great love for soldiers or anyone in the army.
Okay, and you know, when we spoke last September with National Services people. And our friends, we had no idea, Sinead, that we'd be facing a pandemic, as you know, in March.
I know.
And then you're crazy. And then you came on and you sang beautifully for us at the end of the season, as you know, and, you know, such a changed time. But you did say that you were going to head into the front line yourself. Is that coming to pass now? Is that the plan?
Well, what I said was I'm going to go to college and train to be a healthcare assistant.
Sure.
So that in between albums and tours, when you've got a year or two sitting around, I have an occupation. That's something I wanted to do for years. So it's not because of the COVID thing. So it's not that I'm like rushing to the front lines at all. I'm learning how to use Word. It's that early in the game. Like,
yeah, of course.
First, I got to find out, can I write an assignment and can I do the practical work or whatever, you know. And then, as you're aware, the area I want to work in ultimately would be palliative care.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm excited to get started that.
You've signed up, and when do you kick in? When do the pencil case come out from it?
28th of September. That's it. Head down. Yeah.
And is it how many years or what's
it's just 1 year. It's just 1 year.
Okay.
So that's how I'm making use of the time. I had a whole year's worth of shows booked, but they all got pulled because of COVID. So. Mm. And I've wanted to do this course for a few years, but I never could find time free from touring. So that's how I'm making use of the fact that I'm unemployed for the year.
And apart from that fact, which is a pretty prosaic reason, is there a more personal reason for it, or is it just because?
There's loads of personal reasons, many personal reasons. It's something I wanted to do since I was a child, was work in the area of palliative care. But when I was a child, it was only the priests or nuns who really did that. Mm-hmm. And God knows I didn't want to be either of those.
Yeah.
You know, but there are also personal reasons, one of which is, you know, I, the first song I ever wrote in my life when I was 14 was exactly about this. So the desire was there from then. Mm-hmm. But a huge impetus for me was one of my best friends in the world actually died about 5 years ago. And he asked me one night, would I sleep in the bed with him when he had found out he was dying? And I told him I would, but in the end I was too frightened and I didn't. And I felt from then that I would never leave a person alone feeling frightened. I let my friend down very badly. And I figure I'm never good. That's one of the more personal reasons that I figure, you know what, I learned from that, that never to leave a person alone. So my desire is to work with people who are particularly alone. So I didn't leave him alone for like days or anything to get other people in the house, but I didn't get into the bed with him and snuggle him like he wanted me to because I was so frightened.
What were you frightened of?
Of death and dying and of him dying. Basically, I'm sure all the training goes out the window when it's someone that you are so closely attached to. You know what I mean?
Of course. So, and now you're going to hopefully attain your qualification, and you will practice it. You'll be a healthcare supporter, essentially, assistant?
Yeah, and I'll be working in all areas that healthcare assistants would work in, like nursing home work and all kind of work. Obviously, it would take a few years. It would take, God knows, you wouldn't after 1 year be let loose on dying people, you know. You would need a lot of training, so I would imagine it would be 3 or 4 years before I'd be ready to do the work I want to do, which is more or less what you would call being a death midwife. There's a movement of these people called death midwives,
yeah,
where they particularly work with people who are frightened, you know. So obviously no one's going to let me or anyone loose after 1 year of healthcare system training, but you have to, the first step in becoming a death midwife is getting this diploma. So there probably I can work in general healthcare, but I would have to train more obviously before I'm let loose with.
And you, we've been speaking quite a lot actually in recent years about your fascination with American politics, not unlike my own. Are you still,
yeah,
you still CNNing your way through the day?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Did you read anything good book-wise or on the
show? I went through those Kennedy books. I thought they were a bit all over the place,
yeah,
chronologically.
Yeah.
I thought the Mary Trump book was really a bit like, you know, it was very interesting from a female point of view. It was full of gossip. I loved that, but it was a bit like, oh, okay, so you didn't get the money, so you're writing the book. You know what I mean?
You've got Bob Woodward's one coming out now in a couple of weeks. That'll be a cracker, I'd say.
Right.
And,
well, yeah, my concern now is that, you know, I'm among the very few who believe that Trump is actually the scriptural Antichrist. And if that's the case, unfortunately, he may have another 3 years to go.
Yeah, I think he might. Well do. I noticed you said the other day in a tweet that you're knitting. You give a hashtag and knitting compares to you. I mean, that was like a dad joke of the highest order, by the way. A wonderful poem. So tell me about the knitting. Is this new or is it lifelong or what's happening there?
No, I'm a terrible knitter. I can't knit anything except I'm making a blanket for my grandson and I knit winter hijabs, which are full of holes, and I can't knit anything, actually. I just picked it up a few months ago. Bought some friends of mine that showed me just something to do.
Yeah.
It's very addictive. It's quite addictive. It's
so
great for smokers because you smoke less when you're doing it.
Because you're at it. And did you?
Yeah.
Did somebody sit beside you, Sinead, and say, this is how you knit? Or did you YouTube it? Or what was that?
Oh, no, I learned at school. I learned a little bit at school.
Okay.
But what happened was that it was actually some nurses in the hospital sat me down and showed me how to do it again. And it's like riding a bike, you know. But I couldn't knit anything other than, you know, a fat scarf or a blanket. We probably all have a lot of holes in them.
How would you describe the experience of being a grandmother?
It's magical. It's a huge honour. Every time they want to look at you or say your name or, you know, are interested in you. My grandchildren call me Dodo, which I love. There's nobody else in the world calls me that. But I love when I hear Dodo, you know.
Music-wise, let me ask you, you have a new single coming out, I know, I think it's in October, and you've got quite a lineup. You've got David Holmes producing the album, you've got Don Letts doing the video, and so you're surrounded by great people. They're lucky to have you, obviously, on their books too. Do you want to tell me a little bit about the music?
Met David Holmes actually at Shane McGowan's 60th birthday gig.
Yeah.
Where I had sang a song called You're the One. And David came up afterwards and asked me, would I get together with him and let's make an album? So we've been working on that slowly but surely.
Great.
Since then, but very slowly but surely. But we're halfway through this stage. But we were recording a particular track for the album, but we decided it was more appropriate to release it now because of everything that's going on in the world at the moment, particularly in support of Black Lives Matter. So we've got one song which won't now be on the album, but it's just going to be released on October 2nd as a single, which is in support of Black Lives Matter.
And do we have a title for the song? You allowed to tell us?
Well, I'm not allowed
to. Top secret.
I was dying to even give it to you to play, but it's too early because the thing is, it's in aid of Black Lives Matter.
Okay.
And we don't want any leaks because we want the finances going to Black Lives Matter.
Ah, okay.
We want to, you know.
And were you able to shoot a video in the middle of a pandemic, or what? How does that work?
Well, yeah, there are very strict rules. I have to restrict my movement, so I'm like a little hermit at the moment, which I will be for 2 weeks. So I'm not, you know, I'm sticking to the regulations.
Yeah, because you have to quarantine after being away, I take it. Is that it?
You have to restrict your movements.
Restrict your movements, sorry.
It's not as strict as a quarantine. It's kind of 4 out of 5, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, I can go to the store with masked and gloved and get my provisions. You know.
Your messages.
My messages, exactly. That's what my granny used to say.
I get mocked for saying that, but anyway, it must have been.
No, it's lovely.
Is the Honda 50s ticking over or not?
I sold it to the
what?
Mary Wallopers.
Oh,
the
did
Mary
you?
Mary Wallopers, of all people, yeah.
Okay, so that's.
I sold it quite wisely because it's not really a wise move for a 54-year-old lady to be going around and that thing. I broke my blooming back trying to pick it up when I fell off it.
Okay, well, then you did the right thing. Elizabeth was on to say. Tell Sinead about this is on the subject of you not wanting to get into the bed with a guy who said, look, I just need to be comforted because I'm dying. She said, tell Sinead it's okay, this happens, and her friend will have understood that we all die alone, no one comes with us. I've been near death a number of times, and near the end things are clear and you just see your way out of this world as you move towards happiness in the next world. That's her take on it.
Exactly. And I mean, I know that. And I trained as a medium for 20 years in London, which I never really talk about. And that gave me a huge insight into, you know, the certainty that death is like taking your clothes off and we go to a great world of joy, a part of us that always lives in one way. As my 16-year-old son says, we're all one soul. So that's where we go to.
Okay.
You know, so I believe that. But I think possibly it's for the same reason doctors can't work with their own family. Possibly death midwives can't work with their loved ones because all your training would just completely go out the window.
Anne says, regarding knitting, we're really bouncing around here, but just while you're there, regarding knitting, casting on, which I'm sure you know is the expression for
yeah,
casting on, she says, shows hope for the future. It's positive thinking.
Exactly.
Would you agree
exactly.
with that?
I would very much agree with it. And also what I like about it is it's the first time in my life that I have not procrastinated. I actually finished a hijab. It took me about 6 weeks. But I finished it. And the reason I did that, I considered it step one toward college, that if I could actually finish the damn hijab, I could prove that I'm not completely a procrastinator. So, yeah, it was definitely a whole act of hope, this particular hijab.
You sound in really good form. You know, I don't know whether that's the grandchildren's influence on you or whether it's life, broadly speaking, or whether whether pandemic hasn't been as awful for you as it has been maybe for some. I'm not sure. It's kind of suited some personalities, not others. How would you describe where you are in the world at the moment?
Yeah, I'm always really happy when I'm making music. I was getting a bit... I was okay during most of the pandemic. I was enjoying that. I live in a house with my son and his wife and my grandchildren. Mm. I was enjoying that. And I had one child that needed a bit of looking after, so I was kind of pleased in a way, too, that I was there, not away working.
Sure.
So I was fine until about 2 weeks ago. Then I got a bit depressed, actually, because I was bored, just absolutely bored, yeah. Too much to think about. So now I'm really happy again because there's work. You know, music is when I'm happiest, obviously.
Yeah, you always you always say that. And I see the likes of Christy Moore now doing gigs, you know, from wherever they might be, and you sign up and you pay up and you go to the gig, yeah. From your home. Is that something you must be considering?
Well, the way I'm contracted is that the shows that were pulled all this year, I'm contracted to do them next year as they were supposed to have been done this yeah. year. So I'm not legally, contractually bound to not do any shows.
Even online?
Those shows, not even online. Oh, I would have my guts would be had for Nicola.
Hey, listen, thanks so much for talking to us this morning.
All right,
you know, I love talking to you, and you're brilliant. And
yeah, you too, man.
Thanks for your time.
I'll send you the song, but privately, but you can't play it until October 2nd.
Absolutely. I will hold my fire until we can all hear it together. You mind yourself, Sinead. I'll see you very soon, I hope.
Take care.
Take it easy. Kelly Stewart Harcourt, good morning. Welcome to our programme.
Good morning.
It's very nice to talk to you. And I think you obviously thought last week, enough is enough. I'm taking a little ownership about this. What happened when you got wind of the Republican convention and the appropriation of that wonderful character your father played in It's a Wonderful Life?
Well, I hadn't been watching the convention during Natalie Harp's speech. Mm-hmm. And an old school buddy of mine sent me an email and said, can you believe this woman started a speech like this? So I watched the speech on YouTube, and I did something that I've never, you know, I don't really make public statements like that, but I just couldn't, you know, that first, that opening of hers, I just couldn't let that go. So I just wrote what was printed in the Times, and I just posted it on my Facebook page, and a friend of mine said, why don't you send it to the New York Times? And I have never sent a letter to the editor in my life, but I have great respect for the New York Times, and I read it every day. So I got on their website, and I went to their letter section, and I sent this to them. And they let me know the next day by email they were going to – they published it online first, and then they published it in print.
And they said – and obviously it got an enormous response, because anyone who's seen the movie – and who knows anything about your dad, James Stewart, will know that George Bailey is everything that's great about not just America, but about small towns in every country, in every city around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just highlights what's good about human nature.
Yeah. And can you tell... go on, you keep going there.
No, it's just sort of... It's what we like to think of ourselves as being.
Precisely.
You know, yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about growing up in the Stewart household? It must have been very peculiar, given that your dad was one of the most famous people in the world, essentially.
Well, you know, Dad never brought his work to the house. You know, he walked through the front door, and his work stayed outside. So, you know, I wasn't aware that my father was famous until I was about 7, and we weren't affected by it at all. Dad really wasn't, you know, he and Mom didn't court the limelight, and in those days the press was more discreet and everything wasn't about exposing your life to the public. So, you know, I thought we grew up fairly normally in terms of, you know, how families are together in the house. I mean, we were, you know, we were privileged and we were very comfortable, but I wouldn't say that we had a Hollywood upbringing by any means.
And when you think about the back catalogue, let's talk about It's a Wonderful Life for a moment, because it's a film that didn't do great business at the box office initially, but has become this staple of kindness and warmth and decency every Christmas all around the world. because you know, it is amazing. And Kelly, like your dad in that film, the bouncy bonhomie of somebody with the world at his feet descends into the banality of reality and normality, and then bounces back when he realizes actually that mundane is beautiful too, and isn't mundane at all. It's just a story for our time.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's somebody who gave up their dreams to help someone else. You know, they really put other people's lives before them, and at the end they were rewarded.
And did you ever watch that film with your dad?
Oh, every Christmas. You know, because they played it every Christmas. Yeah. And so it's sort of been part of my growing up, is watching It's a Wonderful Life. You know, we'd all gather around in the library and turn the TV on, and, you know, it was just part of Christmas.
And was he, and were you, as moved as people like me, generation later, and so many people listening to the program going, every time, I've watched that movie every single year, and you get moved to tears, or do you just get past that?
No. Are you kidding? I cry every time I see it. In fact, I get irritated. You know, I start watching that film, I say, okay, I am not going to cry when they sing Auld Lang Syne. I refuse to cry. But it happens every time.
Why fight it? Eh? Why fight it, Kelly? It's just, it's there. It's beautiful.
I know.
And actually that scene, I just think it's so brave, that scene where he goes into the bar and he's had enough.
Oh, it's one of the all-time great scenes in movies, I think.
I agree with you. And he puts his knuckles in his mouth and the tears in his eyes. What man or woman hasn't been there where you're just going, I don't know how much more of this I can
but
take.
But that desperation.
Isn't it?
And the hopelessness. I mean, that's some of Dad's finest acting.
Oh, I agree.
That scene.
And I suppose in some ways it was so unexpected, because he was so jolly for all of this film. And in fact, so much of his early films, that sort of sense of decency and hope. And this kind of darkness that he portrayed. I think there was only, was it just one take? He couldn't do it again. It was just too much.
Yeah. But, you know, it's very interesting. I think it's the first film that he did where those kind of emotions came out, and it's interesting that it was his first film after the war.
Yeah.
You know, so his films after the war, I mean, maybe it's because they weren't making madcap comedies anymore. I'm sure that was part of it. But, you know, he changed, and the kind of characters that he portrayed changed. There was much more conflict in the characters that he played when he came back.
He was in the Army Air Corps, Brigadier General, actually, in the Army Air Corps, and fully decorated for, what, about 20 combat missions, flew over Germany as leader of a squadron of B-24s. I mean, I was talking to a guy called Michael Parkinson, a famous interviewer I'm sure you've heard of over in the UK. He always uses your father as an example of actors at a time when they had something to say. In other words, they had a life fully lived. Whereas now, they just, I just moved into a new crib. You go, oh, that's great. Whereas your father was able to say, well, in a very humble way, I did this, that. I mean, this was not just a one-trick pony, your dad.
No. No, and, you know, he never wanted to glorify war. It really affected him. It was, he told me once, it was the most, you know, the proudest thing that he's done in his life for him was his service, his military service. But he never made a war film. You know, he didn't want to glorify it at all. He didn't want to focus the attention on him as opposed to the men that he flew with and some who died. You know, it was just a really important part of him.
And when you talk about how things changed after the war and his roles got, he changed as an actor in some ways. His collaboration with Alfred Hitchcock was extraordinary again, because suddenly you saw this tormented soul in the likes of Vertigo, Rear Window, one of my favourite films.
I know. Mine too. Definitely my favourite Hitchcock film is Rear Window.
Is it really? Why?
Oh, I just think everything about it is so brilliant, and it's creepy, but Dad isn't creepy, and Grace Kelly is so fabulous in it. You know, it's just everything about that film. You're kind of a peeping Tom with him. Well, Hitchcock. Yeah. Nobody made him like Hitchcock did.
I don't mean any disrespect to your mother, but that Grace Kelly kissing your father, James Stewart, in that film Rear Window is my favourite screen kiss of all time. Is that appropriate to say?
I know. No, she was. That was quite a film. Grace Kelly was leaning over Dad's shoulder when he was in the wheelchair and just so close to his face.
Yeah. And I think Hitchcock knew what he was doing there as well. It was masterful in many regards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This may sound like a strange thing to say, but I'm going to admit it anyway as a big fan. When your mother died, Gloria, there was this very small piece in the paper here in Ireland saying that your father was pining for her, that he missed her so much. I thought it was so utterly romantic. I cut it out, and it was 1996. I know this because I sellotaped it to a piece of cardboard and kept it in my wallet as one of the most romantic things I've ever read. And something to aspire to. Romance and dignity and all the good things that somebody would want in their lives. Was your dad for real?
Yeah, he was. You know, and I think that's why he's so enduring with the public, is because he never let them down. He was always what they thought he was. He never strayed from that. And he really was like the characters he played. I mean, he really was a lot like George Bailey.
It's very...
He was for real.
It is very beautiful to hear that. There's a quote from your mother from the Washington Post in the 90s where she said about your father, "The more beautiful and glamorous his leading lady was, the more attention he paid to me."
Oh, yeah. That is so perfect. That's so perfect. It's also so mom.
Is that right?
Yeah. You know, and they had such respect for each other, and they shared this wonderful humor. And that was a big part of their love, was respect and humor.
Your dad, as you well know, and I'm going to play it, the poem he read for the dog, A Dog Named Bo.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about Bo, and why did that resonate with people, and still does?
Well, Dad had we all loved Bo. Bo was his golden retriever, and he sometimes bit people. He could kind of fly off the handle sometimes. You had to be a little careful with him. And we had many funny things, funny experiences with Bo, and it was a real loss when he died. But I'll never forget. I was working in Africa, and I met my parents in Nairobi because they were there on a trip. And I was in Rwanda. I met them in Nairobi, and Dad had written this poem, and my mother and sister Judy were there. And I'll never forget. We were in the hotel room in Nairobi, and Dad read us that poem. We hadn't heard it. And you know, the way he reads it is very moving.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, of course, in tears, and I got infuriated that he would do this to us. And I stood up and I said, "Thanks a lot, Dad. Why don't I jump out the window and kill myself, and then you can write a poem about that?" And I went storming out of the room.
What a reaction. Well, it must have been a very moving experience for you. I mean, the poem is so beautiful, but you were obviously very close.
Oh, yeah, and I tell you, that's another one. I can't hear him read that poem without crying. And in the Johnny Carson show where he reads it, Johnny Carson is crying.
Well, we should have a little listen to it because it's something I've played before, but I want to play it again, seeing as you're here with me.
Let me get some Kleenex.
Get the tissues out. Here it is. This is your father on the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, reading a poem about that beloved dog. And I think anyone who's ever had a family pet that is so beloved will understand where James Stewart is coming from here.
"He never came to me when I would call unless I had a tennis ball or he felt like it. But mostly he didn't come at all. When he was young, he never learned to heel or sit or stay. He did things his way. Discipline was not his bag, but when you're with him, things sure didn't drag. he'd dig up a rose bush just to spite me, and when I'd grab him, he'd turn and bite me. He bit lots of folks from day to day. The delivery boy was his favorite prey. And there were nights when I'd feel him climb upon our bed and lie between us, and I'd pat his head. And there were nights when I'd feel the stare, and I'd wake up and he'd be sitting there, and I'd reach out my hand to stroke his hair, and sometimes I'd feel him sigh, and I think I know the reason why. He'd wake up at night and he would have this fear of the dark, of life, of lots of things, and he'd be glad to have me near. And now he's dead. And there are nights when I think I feel him climb up upon our bed and lie between us, and I pat his head. And there are nights when I think I feel that stare, and I reach out my hand to stroke his hair, but he's not there. Oh, how I wish that wasn't so. I'll always love a dog named Bo.
It's such a beautiful thing. And how is it to hear your father like that, Kelly, on a given day?
Oh, it just makes me miss him, because that's how he talked.
Yeah, he had such a distinctive voice. And the Jimmy Stewart Museum in Indiana is now on my, probably the top of my list. As soon as this pandemic calms down, I'm going to come over and see. What can I expect to see there?
Oh, the Jimmy Stewart Museum is a wonderful place. You know, and it's been going since, I think, the year after Dad died, 1998. And it's what I call an impeccable museum, a small museum dedicated to a subject, but they have done so much over the years. They've educate the public. It doesn't just showcase Dad's legacy and his life. They teach people about the times and the movie business and Dad's military career, and they do outreach with schools, and they've kept it very unpretentious and simple, just the way Dad would have liked it. You know, they didn't get all fancy, and yet they introduced latest technology and things. I mean, I can't say enough good things about the Jimmy Stewart Museum. It's a wonderful little place to go to.
It's a wonderful museum, an appropriate
like
description.
It.
Yeah.
Like it.
Oh, I'm there. I'm in the front of the queue as soon as we're flying again. And you have an Irish connection, of course, because your parents' housekeeper was from this part of the world.
Oh yes, Anne Coyle for years and years. Well, Anne was really became part of the family, and she was, you know, she was there until the end, and then she took the dogs. She took, we had two other golden retrievers, and, you know, my sister and brother and I were not living there anymore, and so Anne stayed around for a while and looked after the dogs, and then she moved back to Ireland.
And you came to visit her?
Been to visit her. She moved to Enniscorthy.
Okay, good. So there was a nice a little green connection between the Stewarts and ourselves here in Ireland, which is lovely.
Oh, yeah. And I've been to Ireland. I love Ireland. I'd love to go back.
Oh, you've got to come and see us when you come over next.
Oh yeah.
We'd love that. When you got that email, just to finish our conversation the way we started it, you got an email to say, "Have you seen what happened at the Republican convention?" It wasn't just any old pal who sent you that, was it? It was a little Hollywood connection, Kelly.
Yeah, it was Trina Mitchum, Robert Mitchum's daughter, who I went to school with. She was a friend, and she said, sent me this. She said, "Kelly, you've got to do something."
we're facing into a presidential election. The whole world watches with bated breath in November, and the feeling among some pundits is that Donald Trump is possibly edging towards four more years. What do you think James Stewart would make of the Republican Party in 2020?
Oh, you know, I miss Mom and Dad terribly, but I'm glad they don't have to see what's happened to their Republican Party. It's not their Republican Party at all. I think they would be pretty appalled.
Okay, yeah, it's a tough time for Republicans of a certain hue. No question about that. Kelly, it's been absolutely lovely to talk to you. We kept you up way too late, and for that we apologise. But it's so lovely to talk to the daughter of the man I've admired for so many years, and to realise that the gene has travelled beautifully. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been very enjoyable. Thanks a lot.
We'll see you soon, I hope. Take care.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you so much. That's Kelly Stewart Harcourt, whose dad, James Stewart, I've been harping on about now since I was probably about 16 years old when I saw It's a Wonderful Life for the first time by accident on television on a wet Sunday afternoon. And I was mesmerised and have been ever since by that man and his acting abilities and storytelling chops. But what a lovely lady she is too. That's Kelly Stewart Harcourt joining us on the phone this morning. The text number is 51551.